think those of us on what I would call the Jewish left have grappled with that reality of what does it mean to kind of to hold your grief and also to act, to say that our grief is not an excuse or should not be a weapon to justify the killing of others, right? War crimes do not justify more war crimes.
Herzlich willkommen bei What's Left, dem linken Podcast zur US-Wahl. Eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Mein Name ist Lukas Hermsmeier, ich arbeite als freier Journalist in New York und ich werde bis November mit verschiedenen Gästen über die dringendsten Themen dieses Landes sprechen. Der Angriff der Hamas auf Israel am 7. Oktober 2023 liegt nun ein Jahr zurück. Ein Jahr fortlaufendes Trauma und unfassbare Gewalt. Die israelische Regierung hat auf das Massaker mit einem Krieg reagiert, den viele Expertinnen als Genozid bezeichnen. Der Gazastreifen ist flächendeckend zerbombt, zehntausende Menschen wurden getötet. Hier in den USA formierte sich nach dem 7. Oktober sehr schnell eine große Bewegung gegen den Krieg. Sichtbar auf den Straßen, online, im Frühjahr dann an den Universitäten. Diese Bewegung war und ist auch deshalb so vehement, weil die USA wie kein anderes Land Israel finanziell und militärisch unterstützen. Und so ist das Ganze auch ein Thema im Wahlkampf. Besonders arabische, muslimische und linke AmerikanerInnen verlangen von ihrer Regierung einen Wandel im Umgang mit Israel. Die absolute Mehrheit der Bevölkerung will ein Ende der Waffenlieferungen. Mein heutiger Gast ist Simone Zimmermann, die nicht nur im letzten Jahr Teil dieser Bewegung war, sondern sich seit langer Zeit gegen Israels Besatzungspolitik einsetzt. Simone kommt aus einer jüdischen Familie in Kalifornien, hat eine Zeit lang selbst in Israel gelebt und wohnt mittlerweile in New York. 2014 war sie eine der Gründerinnen von If Not Now, eine jüdische Initiative, die in Solidarität mit der palästinensischen Bevölkerung steht. Aktuell arbeitet sie für die Organisation Diaspora Alliance, die gegen Antisemitismus und die Instrumentalisierung von Antisemitismus einsteht. Ich bin auf Simone über den Dokumentarfilm Israelism gestoßen, der Anfang 2023 erschienen ist. Es geht darum um ihre Politisierung und um Konflikte innerhalb der amerikanisch-jüdischen Community. Über diese Themen und darüber, wo die Antikriegsbewegung in den USA steht, haben wir mehr als eine Stunde lang gesprochen. Hier ist Simone Zimmermann. Hi Simone, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Simone, it's been almost one entire year since October 7th, and I was wondering if you often or sometimes think back to that day, or is everything basically dominated by what followed that day?
Of course I think back to that day. It was a totally horrific and shattering event that obviously has been the beginning of a rupture and a transformation of the political reality on the ground. And I should also say that I often do think back to that day as well, because I think on that day there was certainly, you know, when I woke up and read the news, I had a sense that something big was happening, but certainly not the extent of how big it would become. And there's a lot to say about, you know, what October 7th meant, what the reaction was on that day and what it's been since. But I guess I'll say two things, which is that, you know, I've been working in the human rights space for quite some time. And for those of us who have been following the reality on the ground, you know, there had been this sense that things were getting a lot worse. You know, in 2023, before October 7th, the Israeli military had killed a Palestinian basically every single day in the West Bank, right? That was a year in which there were these massive protests within Israel against this so-called judicial reform. And the Israeli right that was promoting the judicial reform was very explicit that the goal of that proposed legislation was about removing the final obstacles to making Israeli apartheid and, you know, Israeli control over Palestinians in the West Bank more permanent, more formal within the legal system inside Israel. But the protests against the judicial reform, by and large, refused to even talk about Palestinians and refused to talk about what was happening in the occupied territories. It was mostly Israelis protesting about their concerns about how that would undermine liberal protections for them. And so there already was this sense that, you know, things are getting so much worse on the ground for Palestinians, and it seems like no one's really paying attention to that. And that this situation can't hold. Nobody would agree to live under, you know, such grinding oppression for decades as Palestinian people have been subjected to. And of course, you know, then it, like the actual events of that day, which, you know, took many days for us to really understand the full extent of the horrific cost to Israeli communities and to Israeli civilians on that day. I think often of the term that the Palestinian scholar Tariq Bokoni uses, that it shattered a violent equilibrium in which, you know, Israeli Jews could live thinking that they were safe and living a normal life under, while benefiting from an apartheid system, while Palestinians were living under the grinding boot of apartheid. And, you know, of course, from that day, there was already this sense of what the Israeli military response was going to be. Again, for anybody who's been following these issues for years, we know that every time Israelis are killed by Palestinians, the retaliation against Palestinians by Israel, or even by, you know, Israeli Jews who take the law into their own hands, is always exponentially higher. And so I can say that I already felt that real fear, seeing the numbers of Israeli casualties for what could possibly happen on the Palestinian side. And of course, now we're living through something that is so much bigger and so much more catastrophic and apocalyptic than I think anyone could really imagine. And so, yeah, that's a very long answer to what it has kind of felt like over this last year of just kind of facing, kind of knowing that there was a context. I don't think October 7th was the beginning of any of these issues. And October 7th has also been a pivotal moment that has kind of ushered in this new, I don't even think I can make, I wouldn't try to make clear declarations about what I think this moment is that we're in, but it, I can say that it is just a time of just utter horrors, and so much is changing it that, and we're still living through it.
If you think about the wider circle of people in your life, friends and other activists, family members, did you encounter very different responses to October 7? Was there like a big spectrum of thoughts and feelings within your community?
You mean within the American Jewish community?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. There's a super wide range of responses. And I think, you know, some of what I just mentioned, you know, the idea that there was a context behind these events, even saying that in corners of my community was something that was considered offensive and, you know, inappropriate to say at the time. Of course, the taking of civilian hostages on October 7th and the hostages who have been held in Gaza since then has been an issue that I think is really in the forefront of the minds of many American Jews, because they, you know, there are hostages who themselves were American Jewish Israelis. And, you know, the reality of the Jewish world in the post-Holocaust, the post-Holocaust Jewish world is that many of us do have family and friends in Israel. You know, after World War II, the vast majority of Jews in the world either live in the U.S. or Israel, and there are many ties between our communities. So I think, you know, many American Jews know people who were killed on October 7th. You know, I know somebody who was killed, and I know many people who know many people who were killed. There is a real, there are deep ties, and I think the pain of that day was really felt. And I will also say that for those of us who also, you know, many of us also know people, know Palestinians, know people with families in Gaza. You know, I know somebody who had relatives killed in Gaza already on October 8th, right? And just because I happen to know those people, you know, just because I happen to know people does not, that is not the how I define my lines of solidarity and human empathy. And the death toll that we are seeing on the Palestinian side and the destruction of Gaza that commenced almost immediately after October 7th. The truth of the matter is that Israeli Jews were not actually given space to grieve before their grief was metabolized immediately to support this genocidal war on the people of Gaza. And I think those of us on what I would call the Jewish left have grappled with that reality of what does it mean to kind of to hold your grief and also to act, to say that our grief it is not an excuse or should not be a weapon to justify the killing of others, right? War crimes do not justify more war crimes. Massacres do not justify massacres. And that has been the rallying cry for so much of the political community, I would say, that I'm part of. And I think even more than that, you know, there are a lot of American Jews who are seeing what is happening in Gaza, who have seen the, you know, statements of incitement from Israeli government officials, and they see the parallels. They hear the echoes of the kind of, you know, racist dehumanization that we have been taught to oppose our entire lives, that, you know, resonate because we have heard those same types of, you know, dehumanizing language spoken about our own people in the past. Mm. And they don't want to be we are complicit because we are Americans. Our government is funding and backing this, but I think a very uniting rallying cry for so many American Jews is the idea that these massacres of Palestinians are being committed in our names. And that's why so many American Jews are out in the streets fighting against what's happening in Gaza and calling for a ceasefire, calling for a negotiated cessation that would bring home the hostages, but, you know, first and foremost, being out in the streets and opposed to this mass destruction of Palestinian life that we're seeing happening by Israel, backed by the U.S. government.
And the Jewish left you're describing is a key part of the bigger anti-war movement, right? And this movement started very swiftly after October 7. How did you engage with that movement? And were you surprised how big it was from almost the beginning?
I'm not surprised at how big it was, because I think that, again, we're building on many, many years of movement building in the United States, a growing consciousness about the injustices of Israel's occupation and apartheid regime, growing presence of Palestinian voices in the American media, even in the American political system. I mean, I think even just the very existence of Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, the first elected Palestinian American in Congress, has actually been a meaningful shift in the political discourse in the U.S., where, you know, she has family in the West Bank. She speaks about her family and her life experience in a very personal way. And she is a reminder of what so many in the American political system are trying to kind of ignore or erase or marginalize. So I'm not surprised in that sense. And I think also, you know, the October 7th, both within Israel and in the US, we heard a lot of commentators in the media framing this as Israel's 9/11. Mm. And I think that you know, I suppose for many of the people who were using that analogy, they were saying that that kind of justified this mass retaliation that was to come. But I think for many of us who have any kind of anti-war consciousness, what that also signaled was an event that was absolutely horrific and, you know, had a horrifying civilian death toll, but that also would be used to then justify atrocities of just, you know, magnitudes, many magnitudes greater. And so the message that we were actually hearing a lot in those weeks right after was like, if you actually believe that this is Israel's 9/11, don't make those same mistakes. I mean, President Biden himself actually said that, but then he continued to send shipments of weapons to the Israeli government and allow them to do whatever they wanted in Gaza. But I think I would say the movement in the U.S. took really seriously that the only way that this would that a military escalation was never going to keep anyone safer there, was never going to bring home the hostages, was never going to return any kind of safety to Israelis, and was only going to lead to catastrophe for Palestinians.
If you look back at that, at the last year, would you say that you personally have changed either in your politics to some degree or in your thoughts and feelings about the situation here in the US or there in Israel, Palestine?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think I'm undoubtedly a different person now than I was a year ago. Just the level of grief and horror that we're all carrying and witnessing is, I think that's transformative. I think watching millions of people across this country and, you know, many tens of millions more across the world protesting in support of Palestinian freedom and so little actually changing on the ground, I think that is also a transformative experience. And, you know, I think we're having this conversation right now as we near the anniversary of October 7th. And I can say that I personally and basically everyone I know are asking themselves really hard questions about what does it mean that all of our efforts over the last year have not managed to stop this? And what has it done to all of us that we are watching on our phones every day, you know, the bodies of Palestinian children just ripped apart, families pulling family members out from under the rubble, the fact that now Israel has opened a new front of this escalation or entered a new phase of escalation in these attacks in Lebanon, and the fact that the U.S. government is still sending them weapons, it's hard to make sense of what the vision is for these people besides just the mass destruction of Arab life. And I don't see what future of safety this can offer for Israeli Jews also to be in a society that has become so completely consumed by genocidal animus towards Palestinians and that is so and that you know, Israeli society itself, but all of the world powers backing them are just seemingly uninterested in anything but more escalation. And it's hard to kind of wrap your mind around where this can all go and what this means for the future.
Speaking of this discrepancy between both what happens there and then how much the US government is not stopping that, in fact, really much enabling it, right? And then also the tension you describe between all the energy of the movement, all the protests, all the actions, and the non-effect, basically, at least to some degree, right? It has changed, obviously, people's lives, and like it is a huge moment of politicization and all of that. But do you sometimes fear these two discrepancies lead to bitterness to hopefulness? And do you see that in yourself in some way?
You mean hopelessness?
Yeah, or even bitterness about and like disconnection from all kind of political engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it really isn't clear right now what are the avenues for making political change. And I think, and on top of that, it's not just that people feel like things aren't changing meaningfully to, you know, stop the war, to hold the Israeli government accountable. It's actually that those of us who have been protesting and speaking out are facing incredible repression. So the way that things are changing are actually more aggressively against our movements. So, you know, the college campuses have just returned after summer break, and we've already seen like over 100 campuses instituting new measures that are going to crack down on some way in student speech and student protest. You know, Barnard University, Barnard College, which, you know, has been a site, it's part of the Columbia campus, and it's been a site of
a university in New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of student activism. You know, professors have been instructed not to make political statements, like on their, you know, to have political signs. And I mean, all these things that are just, you know, New York University in New York City has, you know, instituted a speech code that includes Zionist as a protected identity category. Mm. Now, I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here, but maybe I'll just talk for a second about what I see happening on these campuses, which is that, you know, essentially you have these restrictive speech policies that are being set up in the name of fighting anti-Semitism, in the name of protecting Jewish students, which, first of all, they directly end up censoring and impacting Jewish students and Jewish faculty directly. You know, because, maybe I'll go, well, because actually a huge number of the people participating in the Movement for Palestinian Freedom are themselves Jewish. So maybe I'll just actually say a couple of numbers that actually back this up, right? So already before October 7th, this is like polling done back in, I believe, 2022, 40% of young Jewish Americans said that they believed Israel is an apartheid state. And pretty much almost the same number said that they understood Israel's oppression of Palestinians through the same paradigm as that they understood, or as kind of comparative to oppression of Black people in America. So,
and there's a big generational gap, right? Like it is a, we see a clear difference between young American Jews and older American Jews when it comes to views on Israel and Palestine.
Yes. So I think it's also important to say that across the board, not just in the Jewish community, younger Americans are by and large much more supportive, much more sympathetic to Palestinians, much more supportive of policies like a ceasefire, like withholding weapons transfers from the Israeli government. So young people overall in the U.S. tend to be much more progressive. And in the Jewish community, that generational divide is even more stark and even more hotly debated, I guess. Yeah. And today, now this is a number, this is the community overall, this isn't actually just young Jews, 51% of U.S. Jews in a poll done a couple months ago, 51% of U.S. Jews said that they supported withholding weapons from the Israeli military over its invasion of Rafah. Hmm. So it's important for me to kind of say over and over again, this is like one of the key points in many ways, that every time in the U.S. that we have these politicians who say that they're acting to protect Jewish people, what they actually mean is they're protecting one group of Jewish people who happen to be aligned with a certain vision of the Israeli government, you know, that hold, you know, more right-wing pro-Israel politics, when actually, in some cases, those politics go counter to what the majority of our community holds. There's an incredible diversity of opinion in the American Jewish community, not just among young people, but young and old. And over again, we see that the people with the institutional power, political power, and the strongest platforms in media and in our politics are constantly saying that they're acting to support Jews, but really it means one small group of Jews that aligns with this right-wing Israeli government.
And before we talk more about the current political situation and also what has come out of the student movement, I would like to go back in time a little bit. You didn't grow up in a family of leftists, right? How would you describe your upbringing? What political views did you grow up with?
Yeah. So I would say my story is a fairly stereotypical story of one kind of archetype of an American Jew. Actually both sides of my family, we have, you know, immigrants from Europe, from Eastern Europe. On my mother's side of the family, my grandfather actually escaped Warsaw in the 30s. With his family, and his mom was one of the only one of her siblings to escape before the Holocaust. Mm. They moved to pre-state Palestine, and he moved to the U.S. in the 50s to pursue business, essentially. And on my dad's side, my grandfather was actually a soldier in the U.S. Army during World War II. And so he also, you know, a big part of the stories that I heard growing up were frankly from both sides, right, about the horrors of the war and about the destruction of European Jewry. And my grandfather, who was a soldier, like witnessed that with his own eyes. He helped liberate the camps. And my other grandfather had fled those horrors. And so those stories were extremely present in my upbringing. And the idea of never again was very closely tied to a mandate to defend the state of Israel, which, you know, I understood Israel's founding as a direct outcome. You know, of course, I knew that the Zionist movement was founded well before the war, but I think a huge part of the legitimacy of Israel and the mandate to protect it came from this idea of never again for us. And of course, you know, now today there's a debate about does never again mean never again only for us or never again for anyone? And I think I probably got mixed messages about that. I was instilled with this idea of social justice and the idea that, you know, because we have suffered and we have these stories in our history that we should stand with other people who suffer. But I think the primary commitment that I was raised with was to support Israel and to defend the Jewish community. And again, I'm saying these things, all those things were together for me, defending Jews, defending Israel.
Was basically one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about the situation of Palestinian people, of people in Gaza when you grew up? Or was that not part of thinking about Israel? Because you grew up in Los Angeles, it is far away. But like, what part of the reality over there was part of what you knew?
Yeah, it pains me to admit that I knew very little about Palestinians. I mean, I mostly knew that Israel was at war with a group of people called Palestinians. I learned narratives like that they just all want to kill us. You know, we were there first, they can go somewhere else. You know, these very simplistic, very racist, very historically inaccurate narratives about Israel. And when I got to university and I met Palestinian students for the first time, and I began also studying the history, so many of the myths that I had been raised with began to fall apart very quickly.
And in this, in the movie, documentary movie Israelism, there is this one which Yeah, it is partly about your politicization, partly about the situation in Israel and Palestine. There is one quote I think is very remarkable of yours. I wanted to know answers from within my own community, and nobody could answer those questions for me. How is it that I've been through all the trainings, all the programs, and I don't know what the occupation is? I don't know what the settlements are. Is that, quote end, is that the moment where you are changing your views, realizing that there is a different history that you weren't aware of?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, my freshman year of college, I found myself in the center of many of these campus debates. I was, you know, part of student activism to try to stop the passage of a divestment resolution. Pro-Palestinian students were calling on the student government to call for divestment from U.S. companies that had profited from Israel's war on Gaza in 2008, 2009. And before I even the truth of the matter is that I was already sent out there to be an advocate and to fight these things without really understanding what it was that I was defending. Mm-hmm. And there are so many things that I encountered, you know, that shocked me, from hearing testimonies from Palestinian students about the horrors that they and their families lived under, you know, the bombings, checkpoints, discrimination. I mean, all of it. Like, these were stories that were shielded from me in my upbringing. These just weren't part of the narrative that we were taught. And then also, you know, everything from meeting Jewish Israelis who were and Jewish Americans who were criticizing the Israeli government, who were standing with Palestinians. I mean, I had this narrative of kind of my obligations of tribal solidarity, and these people really were shattering that solidarity and saying, it's because of my values as a Jewish person, it's because of my own, you know, hopes for my safety and future as an Israeli that I'm also fighting for Palestinian liberation. And so meeting these activists and hearing all these people's stories really opened my eyes and changed my world. And that quote that you read is really about, because for me at the beginning, I just came home and I just had questions mm-hmm. that nobody was answering. I mean, you know, on so much of the debate in the US right now, and I think it's fair to say in around the world, because this is a key propaganda strategy of the Israeli government, is actually to change the topic away from the reality Palestinians are experiencing and onto a conversation about the discomfort of Jewish people at hearing descriptions of such reality, right? Or accusations of anti-Semitism against the people who are making those critiques. So instead of talking about, you know, how unconscionable Israel's war on Gaza is, instead of talking about, you know, the fact that the Israeli military has destroyed every university in Gaza, that almost 2 million people are displaced from their homes. So often we are having conversations here about, you know, whether the student activists trying to stop those horrors are using the right language, whether, you know, deep in their hearts, if they actually hate Jews, or we're having conversations about how it makes Jewish students feel uncomfortable or feel unwelcome when there is student activism criticizing the Israeli government. I have to say, I really understand where those Jewish students are coming from, because I used to be one of those students. Mm. I also was told that pro-Palestinian student activism was a threat to my safety, and that I was told that I had to go fight it before I even understood what it really was that I was fighting. But it was actually being in the room and hearing what student activists were saying that I realized that there was a huge part of the story that was missing for me. And I became very unconvinced by the answers of the side that I was part of. And so the truth is that my own political journey actually started from this very earnest place of, I just want better answers. You know, I want to be able to refute the things they're saying. If our arguments are so moral and so correct, why can't we make them? Why aren't we engaging in an honest discourse with these people? And I mean, the reason is because what Israel is doing is immoral, and there aren't good arguments to counter why it is that we should be funding, you know, or invested in companies that profit from war and occupation. There isn't actually a good answer to like why it's okay to kill a family in their sleep in their home when you actually have to have that conversation on its merits, which is why they changed the topic.
Simone Zimmermann beschreibt einen schmerzhaften Weg und ich denke, es braucht Courage, sich selbst so öffentlich zu korrigieren. Der von ihr benutzte Begriff Tribal Solidarity scheint mir zentral, und zwar auch jenseits dieses Themas. Ein Appell gegen eine Solidarität, die sich nur nach innen richtet. Im weiteren Verlauf unseres Gespräches geht es um ihre politische Arbeit, den Begriff Antizionismus und wie sich der Krieg im Nahen Osten auf die Wahl in den USA auswirken könnte. Der What's Left Podcast zu den US-Wahlen ist eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung What's und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Beide Redaktionen haben Personal und Zeit investiert. Finanziert wird der Podcast vom Recherchierfonds ProWatts. Wenn Sie mithelfen wollen, dass Projekte dieser Art auch in Zukunft umgesetzt werden können, spenden Sie auf prowatts.ch und abonnieren Sie eine oder gleich beide Zeitungen.
After you finished college in 2013 or 14, I think, right? You found 13. You found a group called If Not Now. What was the purpose back then and now, and what kind of activism or political work is it that If Not Now does?
So If Not Now grew out of, it was a group of young Jews who at the time we, you know, wanted to protest the war in 2014, and we wanted to do so also rooted in Jewish tradition. We wanted to use Jewish mourning rituals. We wanted to be in community, and we wanted to bring our dissent to the doorsteps of Jewish institutions. I'm sad to say that about 10 years on, we're in a moment in which those institutions are even more firmly supportive of the horrors on the ground. I mean, I think it's fair to say that as U.S. Jewish support for Palestinian rights has grown exponentially over the last decade, and even in the last year, I would say that there is even less space inside Jewish institutions themselves in the U.S. For any kind of vision of support for Palestinian rights. And those institutions have become even more aggressively and even more even more aggressively supportive of Israel and of its policies, which means that many of the Jewish institutions in the U.S. are complicit with genocide.
And what kind of institutions do you mainly mean?
I mean everything from, like, you know, synagogues to community organizations to organizations like AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the most powerful pro-Israel lobby in the U.S.
How do they intervene, or like what does their work look like?
So AIPAC for decades has lobbied the U.S. government to support pro-Israel politics and to make pro-Israel politics a kind of bipartisan consensus issue. And we've seen, as more and more Democrats, more and more progressives, Americans in general, are questioning the Israeli government, and as the Israeli government has become even more unabashedly right-wing, AIPAC has actually doubled down in support of this right-wing government. So, I mean, today, you know, you have explicit Jewish supremacists in the Israeli government, right? This is a government that is, even before October 7th, we could hear explicit calls for ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, explicitly racist, homophobic government ministers, people who consider Reform Jews, which is the largest denomination of American Jews. There are ministers in the Israeli government who don't consider Reform Jews legitimate. And don't support the same, the very policies of, you know, religious diversity and inclusion that make the fabric of American Jewish life what it is. So there's a very I think many of us who have campaigned in the American Jewish community are often just trying to point out to our communal leaders that they support people with whom they do not share any values, and people who, in fact, are even hostile to the values that they hold. But this idea of the support for the state clearly has been prioritized over any real concern for what the character of the state is, what the state actually does. And of course, over the last year, that could not be more devastatingly clear what the cost of that has been and how far many of these people are willing to go.
I would like to talk a little bit about some terms, because I think besides certain like right-wing forces, who conservative forces, sometimes also forces of the center, who instrumentalize both the war and the movement for their own purposes and don't really act in good faith. In my experience, at least, both in the US, but mainly in Germany, in Europe, there is sometimes like a genuine confusion about terms, for example, Zionism and anti-Zionism. When I speak about the Jewish left, or like write about the Jewish left and say that many of those people consider themselves to be anti-Zionist, they find it almost difficult to understand what that means. Do you use that term for yourself? Would be my first question. And then if so, how would you define it? And then also, is there a spectrum of how people understand anti-Zionism for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the first question I can just answer is that, yes, I do call myself an anti-Zionist. And the reason I consider myself an anti-Zionist is because, first of all, what it means to Palestinians, Zionism for Palestinians means, I think I'm going to give a very simplistic, but I think fairly accurate definition of how I think it's defined, as the establishment, it's the movement and the ideology that established a state for Jews on Palestinian, in Palestine, and that required the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from that land in 1948, and requires the continued Nakba, the continued domination and dispossession of Palestinians from their homeland in order to maintain a Jewish, a state that prioritizes the rights of Jews at the expense of Palestinians.
I would like to talk one more time about the movement against the war, against the occupation, against Israel's politics and government right now. We saw, and you have mentioned that already, the big student movement in spring. Do you see lasting infrastructure coming from that movement? Because there was the summer break, and like most of the encampments were raided, were like stopped by the police, but also it calmed down a little from student side, obviously. Where do you see that movement? Is that movement now, and where is it going?
So I'm not so involved in the student movement, so I can't speak to it like so directly, but I what I can say is that, you know, that what we saw happening in the spring was so inspiring, and I think inspiring to people around the world. It was a reminder that what we're living through right now is a profound moment in history and a movement for justice that is not going away. I was privileged enough to get to participate in some of the actually Jewish ritual gatherings at Columbia University in New York City. And I got to participate in both Shabbat services and in a Passover Seder, where each one, there were over probably 100 young Jews participating in them. And the other students in the encampment, you know, even set up a kind of like protective ring around us and told people beyond to kind of quiet down right after the Shabbat service. Then there was a Muslim prayer service that evening. So there, you know, despite what we've seen, the cruder representations that we've seen in mainstream media, there's been actually something incredibly beautiful and vibrant and diverse happening.
And representation, you mean the media coverage, and that was the case in Germany too, that this is basically a very anti-Semitic movement.
Exactly, yeah. And it's important to say that so many of the student encampments are filled with Jewish students. Jewish students are perhaps even overrepresented in much of this movement because of the personal, you know, both connection that we have to this issue and the feeling that as Jews, we have a unique obligation to speak out against a war that is being waged in our name. I think what it's important to say about what's happening on the encampments right now is that, you know, university is meant to be a space of learning and also a space of protest. College campuses have always been historic places of student protest, and the repression that is being rolled in to criminalize and penalize these student protesters, I think it's going to have the opposite effect. I think that, you know, repression never actually makes the movement go away. It just makes it perhaps radicalizes it, right? And makes the cost of participation much higher. But it's not going to stop people from caring about what's happening in Gaza. It's not going to stop people from learning about it or talking about it. And it's not going to stop people from wanting to see justice and accountability for Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Have you also seen slogans or like tendency within the movement you are in solidarity with that you think are problematic? Or is that in your eyes mainly or only an exaggeration?
I would say yes to both, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, every movement has elements in it, you know, the most extreme elements. There's always, I've never been to a protest in which I saw signs, every single sign I agreed with. You know, that's not what mass protests are. But the media has a knack for finding the most offensive signs and trying to use those to kind of smear the movement as a whole. So yeah, I would definitely never say that I think every slogan or every sign I see is something that I agree with or support. And I think that also a lot of these voices are being kind of lifted up to delegitimize the movement as a whole.
There are several reports saying that anti-Semitism has been on the rise since October, and you have, especially since October 7 last year, and you have also talked about that before. What kind of anti-Semitism do you see on the rise?
Yeah, this is really important. So the first thing I can say is that, you know, this is a kind of well-documented phenomenon that whenever there's violence in the region, that anti-Semitism and Islamophobia tends to increase abroad, right? As Peter Beinart has written, Americans have a very ugly tradition of blaming domestic communities whom they perceive as being connected with issues happening abroad. So, you know, when Americans are angry at China, they tend to, there we see a rise in anti-Asian sentiment. When violence happens in Israel-Palestine, we see a blowback on Jewish and Muslim communities. So that's obviously one of the reasons also that I think Americans should support a ceasefire, is that we are not there. The blowback, the ripple effects of U.S. involvement in the conflict over there, Americans are not insulated from that. This is not something that has no bearing on our lives. So, of course, I mean, we have seen rising anti-Semitism. And the second thing that I want to say is that that's also why I'm against the conflation of all Jews with Israel. You know, the loudest voices in American politics, in the American Jewish community, continue to insist that standing with Israel and standing with Jews are the same thing. Now, if you're just a regular American and you are seeing the horrors in Gaza on your social media, and you are against Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians in Gaza, you're also hearing that this is being done. I mean, President Biden says it repeatedly that he's doing this to keep Jews safe, right? And it is understandable. I do not support it. I do not excuse it, but I do understand why many people would have the perception that all Jews support this, because they're hearing over and over again that this is being done on our behalf, which is why it's so important. I would even say that this is one of the ways that we fight anti-Semitism. When Jewish leftists are in the street protesting the war, saying not in our name, because it breaks that public perception that all Jews and Israel are the same thing, right? And so that's another thing. I have two other things I want to say about this topic, but feel free to interrupt me. Then there's groups like the Anti-Defamation League, which is the so-called kind of leading civil rights organization for American Jews that has really become a very aggressive pro-Israel advocacy outfit. And they released data that actually, they released data about the rise of anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. in 2023. And some reporters at Jewish Currents magazine, which is a left-wing Jewish magazine here in the States, actually looked into that data to try to understand what can we actually learn about what's happening as far as anti-Semitism in the U.S. And these researchers uncovered a couple of things that are pretty interesting. So the first thing is that it's important to say that the ADL actually cites protests led by Jews as anti-Semitic incidents, right? So like a significant number of these so-called anti-Semitic incidents were protests by groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace. And
that was based on what was the anti-Semitism they saw there?
They just conflate being pro-Palestinian, pro-ceasefire with being against Jewish people, right? So let's take out all of and then pro-Palestinian rallies broadly, not just led by Jews, were also included in those incidents. So, you know, the Jewish Currents report looked at these numbers and said, okay, let's take out the incidents that actually are really just anti-Israel. They're not anti-Semitic. And then let's look at the numbers of the other incidents that we would agree really are anti-Semitic. And what they found was that the vast majority, even within the very faulty data that the ADL is putting out, the vast majority of incidents that they would agree are unequivocally anti-Semitic are mostly coming from far-right groups who are also white nationalists, who are also anti-LGBT, who are also Islamophobic. And so even
It's fascist.
Fascist, right-wing groups. And so it's just pretty astounding and painful and outrageous that the organizations whose mandate is to protect American Jews are actually not fulfilling their own missions, because they are so concerned with protecting the Israeli government from criticism and accountability that they are willing to turn an eye to the groups that even their own data shows are posing a direct threat to American Jews. And we've seen also over the last year that even within the Anti-Defamation League, there have been resignations of their own staff because their staffers are saying, you are not fighting real anti-Semitism. You know, the way that Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, has played very nicely with Elon Musk, at the head of Twitter, as he has unleashed just like a torrent of anti-Semitism on that platform. And Greenblatt is not holding him accountable.
In July, Simone, you wrote an op-ed for Teen Vogue, and that was at a moment right after Biden pulled out of the campaign and Kamala Harris took over. And you were urging the Democrats and Kamala Harris to listen to young people's concerns about the war. Have you seen a change since then? Because both Biden and Harris are constantly saying they are working on a ceasefire, and yet at the same time sending weapons, not really substantially changing their politics. Do you see any change? How do you see the politics of the Democratic Party right now?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty depressing to think about the fact that you know, in October and November and December, those of us who were calling for a ceasefire and were saying that there is no military solution, that the only way to bring the hostages home is through a ceasefire, that this war is only going to lead to just mass destruction. But we're criticized for calling for this word. Ceasefire was like a scary word to use at the time. We're now seeing both Biden and Kamala use ceasefire as this kind of platitude to say, yeah, this is, we're working so hard for a ceasefire, but they're not actually doing anything to get us there. I mean, it's kind of like the same way that for years we've already heard American officials say, oh, we're working for a two-state solution, while they're, you know, enabling Israel to expand settlements, you know, deepen its annexation of the West Bank and ensure that there will never be a two-state solution. So this has become, ceasefire has just become another one of these, platitudes or ways to gaslight the public and to say that they're doing something when they're actually doing nothing but cover for Israel, buy Israel more time to continue its destructive policies. And I think a lot of young people see through that gaslighting. And I really worry about, you know, that feeling of despair, that feeling that we're being lied to by our politicians. You know, the fact that the Uncommitted Movement asked the Democratic National Committee to just allow a Palestinian speaker to be on stage
at the convention.
At the Democratic National Convention. I mean, baseline, bare minimum request, and they wouldn't even do it. Mm. And what does it say about the state of American politics that there isn't even room for this basic recognition of Palestinian humanity and of the incredible suffering that our government is responsible for funding and the, you know, also for the families of American citizens. I mean, this is what this whole debate in Michigan is about. It's, you have Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, Lebanese Americans whose actual family members are being killed by US bombs right now, right?
Do you think it will influence the election in November because of the growing resistance towards the US involvement?
I do. I feel really worried about what's going to happen in November as the US government is essentially letting Netanyahu open up a new front of this war. And it's so clear that he wants Trump to win. You know, when he was here in the US, he brought Trump a hat, you know, that said total victory. I mean, the global far right, not just Netanyahu and Trump, but you know, Modi and Le Pen, like these are allies across the world, right? They are cheering each other on. Viktor Orban, these people, they're cheering each other on. They share a vision of a world of, you know, increased like walls and policing and borders and racism and fear. And that's what this coalition is. And the fact that the Democrats are unwilling to stand up to this, when it seems so clear to me that they, that Netanyahu wants them to lose, that he is not a partner. I mean, it makes you feel pretty crazy, I have to say. And I have tremendous appreciation for all the organizers who have been trying to do something within our political system right now, just, you know, pushing a boulder up a mountain. And it's, I'm really worried about what's going to happen in November.
In the end, a question or two questions for that I'm asking every guest related to the topic of our conversation. What would you say, Simone, is a thing when it comes to the movement against the war, what we talk about too much? Is there like an overemphasis on something in the discourse? Or maybe also in our conversation, in my questions?
Whoa. That is a good question. I feel like I want to think about that, but now I have to speak off the cuff. I mean, I guess the obvious one that I could say is that I think this conversation about the discomfort of Jewish students on college campuses is something that is overrepresented in our conversation. We don't hear about the discomfort that, you know, Palestinian and Muslim students and Arab students face on campuses who have to go to class while their family members are being killed. We don't talk about what it is like to be, you know, a left-wing or anti-Zionist Jewish student on campus who's who are being told that their own identities and political views are anti-Semitic when they themselves are Jewish. I don't know if there is, it is possible to overrepresent the destruction in Gaza, the complicity of US officials. I mean, all of it is a scandal. And I think every day people in mainstream media, like, we're still not getting the extent of those stories of the destruction that our government is responsible for, and the complicity that they, I mean, you know, even just in the last couple of days, we have this story coming out about how Blinken, Secretary of State Blinken, had the information that Israel was blocking the entrance of life-saving, you know, food and medical aid into Gaza. And yet, and under U.S. law, that means that the U.S. government, it is illegal under American law to continue to send weapons to a government that is denying food and medicine from a population. And yet we've continued to do it for almost a year now. So
my last question would have been, what is it that we don't talk about enough? Would you say, based on your last sentences, is it the details of this war, the mechanisms of the war, the involvement of the US? Is that still the number one thing we don't talk about enough?
I mean, of course, I think because, like, we're in, you know, in the US, it feels like, I think the other thing that I would say is, I mean, I read a report last night about what it actually was like to be up in Lebanon. I read these, like, harrowing personal testimonies of people who actually were there when all these pagers are exploding, you know, a doctor examining a baby on, like, in a hospital as the baby's father's, like, hand is blown off, you know, and the doctors, the Lebanese doctors who all of a sudden overnight had to operate on thousands of people with the same exact injury. And just the, you know, I think in the US we get sold this kind of Hollywood-esque, you know, image of Israeli military as these kind of, like, you know, ingenuous, like, you know, super high-tech fighters, and not on the actual horror and terror that these policies are wreaking on the people who are living them. So, I mean, I don't think there can be enough of that, about the real deep understanding of what our governments, U.S. weapons and U.S. government backing are supporting across the world. It's hard to overstate the catastrophe that is happening for people across the world right now, for Lebanese people and Palestinian people. And I also don't think that we're talking enough about, like, what the real costs of this are all going to be on the American people, the deep, I mean, even the despair that we're talking about. I don't know what to say about psychologically what that is doing to an entire generation and to an entire populace that is witnessing these horrors from far away and feels powerless to stop them. I mean, all of that's what we're living through. And of course, we don't get that kind of reporting in, you know, a lot of media platforms, because then, I mean, people in power would have to do something about it.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Simone. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This was really nice to talk to you.
Simone Zimmermann hat in unserem Gespräch immer wieder betont, dass die Aufmerksamkeit vor allem bei den Menschen sein sollte, die direkt von diesem Krieg betroffen sind. Also in Gaza, im Westjordanland, in Israel und Libanon. Die Frage, die sie gegen Ende gestellt hat, was es mit den Menschen hier in den USA politisch und psychologisch macht, so lange zu protestieren, aber kein Wandel der Politik und kein Ende der Gewalt zu sehen. Diese Frage stelle ich mir allerdings auch. Eine Studie nach der nächsten zeigt ja, dass gerade junge AmerikanerInnen wenig Vertrauen in die Institution des Landes haben. Für viele ist der Fakt, dass die USA diesen Krieg möglich machen, eine Bestätigung der Entfremdung. In der nächsten Folge von What's Left geht es um die Gewerkschaftsbewegung. Ich spreche mit der legendären Journalistin Jane Slaughter. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Dieser Podcast ist eine Koproduktion von der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik, finanziert durch den WOTS Recherchierfonds. Am Podcast beteiligt sind Ur Gültekin, Kaspar Surber, Jan-Ole Arps, Payam Masumi, Helen Derik und Lukas Hermsmeier.